like to call the meeting to order. I'm delighted to see such a good turnout. We set up 165 chairs, and I don't think that's going to be enough. We'll have to get some more. But this is such an important subject.
Can we say good morning again?
We're making a DVD of this meeting, and this is our recorder, and he says, for me to start again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the Space Coast Condo meeting. I'm delighted to see so many people here. If we run out of chairs, we'll put more chairs up. Good turnout. If you'd rise, please, for this Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Be seated. I'll give you an update on our membership. We have three associations that have joined since our last meeting. If anybody's here from those associations, stand up. We'd like to know that you're here. Essex Condominium Association. Magnolia Key Condominium. Good. Glad you came. And Seashore Estates Condominium. We have a number of businesses that have joined. All Florida Shutters. If somebody's here from there, stand up. All Florida Shutters, Armstrong's Cleaning and Restoration, Robert Beals, an attorney, Diversified Construction and Restoration, Existing Structures and Engineering, Green Building Concepts, Hurricane Product Warehouse, Perry Roofing Contractors, Reagan Equipment Company, and Smart Street Division of the RBC Bank. Now, since our last meeting, we've also dropped three associations and 13 businesses. If they don't pay, they get dropped. So our current membership consists of 18 individual associates, 150 businesses. That's a heap of businesses, believe me. 264 associations with some 19,459 units. Is my treasurer here, Clay Witt? There he is. Clay, could you give the treasurer's report, please?
Good morning, everyone. I'll make this fairly short. This year we're going to be mailing out year-end financials to everyone sometime within the next couple of weeks. So you'll get our profit and loss statement and our balance sheet shortly. And we think we're doing pretty well. We finished the year with a paper loss of $5,175, but that was actually good news. As I've mentioned here a couple of times before, we have been embarking on a program this year to create an updated computer system centralized to track all of our members and to produce the member directory and some other things, and that's now largely finished, and we were able to pay for more than half of that out of current income, and the figure I just mentioned is the rest of what that project cost us, but that's a one-time cost, and should serve us well for years and years to come to give you better service. We finished the year with no debt of any kind, And we have total current assets of $30,624.49. So we're quite sound. And thank you very much for being faithful in your dues payment.
Are there any questions for Clay? You will be getting the data, as you said, probably more data than you'll assimilate. I would like to mention that Key Enterprises Management Company furnished the cookies. The goodies over here, all courtesy of Key. They've done that several times, been very good about that, and we do appreciate that. I brought about 75 copies of Florida Statute 718. There are a few left over. Don't get up and rush over to get them, but there are a few left over, which I would be glad to give away. The next meeting is going to be February the 20th, 2009. And let me mention about these programs. You know, we did have Representative Julio Rubina scheduled to speak today. And as I anticipated, he backed out. In case some of you don't know, he, for the last 3 years, has written legislation that generally has been quite bad. And we have fought him tooth and nail, and we have won each time. There are a few undesirable things that got into the law as a result of his activities anyway, but all in all, we have won the battle with him. This year, he says he's going to straighten out the HOA laws the way he did the condo laws. As of yesterday, he had not filed a bill yet. But at any rate, he was scheduled to speak, and he backed out. And I was just as glad, because it's become acutely obvious that the primary crisis facing condominiums and other associations in the state is the problem with foreclosures. It's particularly bad in condos, because if you foreclose, well, there are several problems, which I'm not going to go into, but if you do foreclose, you'll frequently find yourself in a position, usually prior to foreclosure, where the owners have quit paying their fees. They've essentially abandoned a unit in some cases. They don't take care of it. And the remaining owners have to pay all the expenses, which would normally be spread among the total number. But if some of the people skip out, quit paying, the other unit owners have to make that up. And that's a tough situation, particularly in this economic crisis that we have. And so we have divided the subject essentially into two parts. One today is on foreclosures, liens, this sort of thing, and it's far more than just a procedure, far more than a how-to. Got in touch with Paul Ween on this because his firm specializes in these things, and I don't know of anybody who knows more about the subject than they do. And Paul came out with two of his attorneys, very attractive attorneys, I might say, which is...
No sexist comments.
My apologies. I should not have said that. Now, I'm not going to go into much about their backgrounds. I've got pages of material on this, but Paul has spoken to us many, many times. He used to be in Orlando with Becker and Polikoff. He's had his own firm for a number of years now. I don't know what, 10, 12 years?
13
years. He's had his own firm as long as I've been on the board of Space Coast Condo, I guess. He has two other people. I'm going to let Paul amplify on this. But Aaron McConnell, I had not met before this morning.
found out that she was born in the same obscure part of the country that my wife was born in, so she must be good. Then we have Helena Melko. Is it Melko or Melko?
Melko.
I thought it was. That's where the Wien and Melko names come from. Now, Helena spoke to Space Coast once upon a time. It's been a good many years now. Did a brilliant job. I was extremely impressed with it. I told her so at the time. It's a brilliant presentation. And I'm delighted that she's here again today. And I'm going to let Paul give you some of the background information about his two colleagues. The trouble is I have more information than I know what to do with. So with that, Paul.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you, folks. For any follow-up information about any of us, you can go to our website, which is WMLO.com.
Pause?
Sure.
Can I get you wired up? Are you going to be speaking first?
Yep.
Okay.
We're going to do this to everybody.
Yes, oh, that's
need
for the house.
The house for the DVD.
Gotcha.
Okay, gotcha. Okay. Thank you, Harry. Thank you, Harry. All right, take three. Thank you, Harry. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I especially appreciate the opportunity to be here in lieu of Representative Robina. I'm not a big fan of his. I know he's not a big fan of any attorney. So it's nice to be able to give you some hopefully correct information. He can stay down in South Florida and run his little fiefdom down there. By the way, there is bad legislation that's already been filed. His group that went around the state last year consisted of, among other people, Representative Ambler. Representative Ambler has already pre-filed a bill that it has bad stuff for condos in it. So that's one bill that has been pre-filed. There is another bill that has been pre-filed that would remove the requirement for owner insurance on their units and basically put you back to the position where if the owner doesn't have insurance and you're not obligated to insure it as an association, well, it doesn't get rebuilt. So it's not very realistic. I know in economic hard times, people don't want to have to pay additional charges, but when you live in property that you own with others, particularly in a vertical setting, you need to have all of the people who are related to that business carry their share. And that is what the current bill on insurance requires. We have put out a proposal, which is Senate Bill 880. By we, I mean the Florida Legislative Alliance. That bill was just filed. It's now available online. Hopefully you can take a look at that. And as far as I know, it's the only bill so far that addresses the issue of foreclosures for condos. And we're going to talk a little bit about how that goes. But before I start, let me first introduce my partner and friend, Helena Melko. Helena came to work with me back in 1992 and just took over the collection practice in the firm I was with at the time. And when I left to start my own firm, I was thrilled that she decided to come with me, and she tested my heart very quickly. The day we left that firm, she told me she was pregnant with her first child, not mine, by the way. She's happily married, and so am I. But we did make it through. She said, don't worry. As I started to wobble, she said, we'll make this. So she did. She's now had two children, and that's been what she's been doing when she's not working. So it's been a while since she's been here, and that's the reason why. Erin McConnell, I won't go through the entire story, but I will tell you briefly. I met Erin as a result of her late brother, Mark. And Mark was a young boy who had a life-threatening illness and desired to see the attractions. And he got a chance to go to a charity where my wife works called Give Kids the World. And Mark turned out to be a talented, very personable person. And eventually, the putt-putt course at Give Kids the World was named for Mark. So it's now called Mark's Dino Putt. And when Erin wanted to go to law school, I first tried to dissuade her. And she went anyway. And she went to the University of Nebraska, which I didn't know they had laws out there. But she did graduate and asked me if I would swear her in. And so we went to Mark's Dino Putt, and that is where I swore her in. I had no idea or intention of hiring her, but I found myself shortly thereafter in need of an attorney. She found herself shortly thereafter in need of a job. We somehow managed to hook that up, and she's been with us now, what, 3 years? And she has handled, we kind of branched off from Helena. Helena does all of our lien foreclosures and collections, and Erin does all of our defense of mortgage foreclosures. And that's why we're all here to talk to you. Now, let me very quickly give you a quick overview. When somebody owes money to someone else in Florida, and you file some sort of an action to recover it, we got rid of debtors' prisons shortly after Charles Dickens wrote Bleak House. And so if you get a judgment against a person, all you're really doing is getting a determination of liability. There is no order to pay. You can't be placed in jail or held in contempt. Once I've got a determination that you owe me money, now I've got to figure out how to try to collect on that. And that's a whole nother process. What you have in a foreclosure process is you have a little extra. You don't just have a debt. You have a debt, but you also have security. The security is the property. Okay, so when you go out and borrow money to buy a home, a condo, you go to a bank and you give them a so-called voluntary. It's voluntary because if you didn't give it to them, they wouldn't give you the money. So you give them a voluntary consensual lien on that unit. It's called a purchase money mortgage. So you give them a mortgage, they give you the money, you get title to the property. And so long as you pay that mortgage, you get to keep ownership of it. But when you stop paying, now the bank has two options. It can go after you and get a personal money judgment against you for $250,000. And of course, if they get that judgment, what do they do with it other than try to find some asset with which to recover? So nobody ever uses that remedy, which we call in personam. It's against the person. Instead, what they do is they use the remedy called in rem, R-E-M, which is Latin for the thing. And what that means is we're not going after the person, we're going after the property. And that is what a foreclosure action is. When you file that foreclosure action, you are seeking to recover your debt from the property. And so in a typical foreclosure, there will be an order issuing a right to foreclose. You'll be advertised, and then a sale is held, and voila, you lose property. So what about the association? Well, by statute, the association also is given a lien on the property. It is not consensual. It is by operation of law. So you have a mandatory lien on every unit that is deemed to have arisen as of the date your declaration of condominium was recorded. And there is only one exception to who might have a superior lien to you, and that is a purchase money mortgage. So when a bank lends to somebody to buy a unit, they get a first mortgage, and by law, your lien becomes subordinate to the bank's. Okay, do y'all understand that important aspect? That's why these mortgage foreclosures that Erin's going to talk about are so important to you. Because depending on what happens to them, that may affect your ability to recover your debt. The other thing that I want to make clear before I turn it over to Erin is this. When I said that the mortgage was a consensual lien, I meant it. It means that I go to the bank, I borrow money, they give me a note, and I sign it. They give me a mortgage, and I sign it. Who is liable to pay that debt? The person who signed it. Does the association ever have a legal duty to pay a first mortgage? Exactly. Please understand that. A lot of people don't understand it. Unless the association signed the note and mortgage, it has no obligation to pay it. However, if the association acquires title in a lien foreclosure, it is subject to losing that title when the bank with the superior lien comes in and forecloses. So the only time you would want to pay it is if you are hell-bent on keeping ownership of that unit. Does everybody understand that? Okay, we're going to leave plenty of time for questions. So with that background, what I'd like to do is have Aaron come up and talk to you about, briefly, the mortgage foreclosure process, a brief overview, and then we're going to try to give you some strategies that you can use in that context to try to minimize the likelihood that you're going to get stiffed. Helena will then come up and talk about the lien foreclosure process, a brief overview of how that goes, and then give you some strategies for try to keep yourself out of that need for that suit, and once you're in suit, to try to recover the best ways to do it. And then I'm going to get back up and shoot off my mouth and try to give you some non-judicial and some legislative solutions that we can look at, some hopefully creative ideas that you might want to think about in terms of operational issues that you can change within your community to try to maximize your chance of not having to go into collection to begin with. Okay? So with that, I'll bring up Aaron McConnell. This off. Okay.
Unfortunately, I don't have any pockets.
You have a pocket right here?
Is this a pocket?
No, that's not
a pocket.
No, it's just that. How
about back here? Nope, that's just a tag. How about if you just put it there on the sheet?
No, I can stand right here.
That'll be fine. We can put it right here.
All right. Okay,
and
wonderful.
When I point to you, go.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Erin McConnell, and as Paul said, I'm going to be discussing the mortgage foreclosures, because if any of you have turned on your television or opened the newspaper at all in the last few months, you've seen that we are in a mortgage foreclosure crisis. And this especially affects the condominium associations, because once you have someone who is in mortgage foreclosure, it becomes less and less likely that they will pay the association assessments, and more likely that they will be out of that unit within some time. That leaves you an empty unit then that your other owners have to pick up the slack for as far as payments in your budget. Right. If you've been a part of associations for the few years, you've known that you get a mortgage foreclosure maybe once or twice a year. Lately, you've been getting them once or twice a month, and in some cases, once or twice a week. As far as our clients go, at first I was getting perhaps 5 a week. Now I'm getting 5 to 10 per day in order to answer and defend for the associations. So it has become an entire portion of our practice and where it was non-existent before. So what I'm going to do is the handouts that you have, I'm going to go through those bullet points so you can fill it in. If you have any questions, you can go ahead and pass them to the front, and we're going to take those at the end. But otherwise, you can just follow along through there. And this is pertaining to condominium associations. If you are a master association or a homeowners association, there are different rules and scenarios that apply to you. And if you have questions about that, I'm happy to discuss them with you at the end. But this portion of my presentation is going to be directed towards the condominium associations. All right, so first of all, I'm going to give you an overview of the mortgage foreclosure process so that you can understand it and be prepared so that you can deal with this in your own associations and be able to make it through this. Now many of the economists are projecting that the economy is not going to rebound until about 2011 as far as the housing market goes. So it's very important that you understand the process and procedures of these mortgage foreclosures, and then we're also going to give you some tools as to how you can prepare for these within your association. First of all, when the association has any of its members that has a mortgage foreclosure, the association is going to receive a summons. This is because you are also a creditor and you have a secured interest in that property. The mortgagee is attempting to serve you because they want to foreclose your interest in that property. It's important when you get this packet that you take a look at it. The first page is always going to have the summons, which is going to list all of the parties that are involved in the foreclosure, and it's going to list the association in its name as a party. It's important that you take a look at the name that's listed and make sure that it is your association and that it's listed correctly. There are many times, because these mortgagees have so many foreclosures that they're handling at the same time, that they will misname the association, or there's many associations that also have similar names, especially in the Brevard and Volusia areas, because you can have Ocean Vistas, Ocean Villas, and sometimes if the property description is not clear, they may list the wrong party as the named party. You'll also take a look, it'll have the Liz pendants following that, that'll have all the parties named, and then follows the plaintiff's complaint, followed by the actual copy of the mortgage foreclosure. Now, when you go to submit this to your attorney, make sure that you send them the entire package. If you want to keep any of these papers for the association records, go ahead and make a copy of what you think is important for the association to maintain on file, but send the entire packet to the attorney, because you don't know what information might be in that packet that the attorney will need in order to make the answer for the association. All right, now why it matters to file an answer. The association has an option when you receive the mortgage foreclosure. Now you have the option to forward it to the attorney and have them follow it and file an answer or notice of appearance for the association. There are some associations, however, who have been keeping these packets. I would strongly advise you to at least contact your attorney and let them know that you have this packet for this owner. It's going to make a difference in your collection policies, because if there is a mortgage foreclosure on this property and this owner owes any money to the association, or in the future will owe any money to the association, it's important that your attorney has that information so that they can avoid having future attorney's fees expended toward that individual that would be trumped by the mortgage foreclosure action. So even if you choose not to file an answer, it's important that you let your attorney know that this is out there so that they know that there is another secured interest against this property. The attorney will likely need to research the mortgage and let you know if it's a first mortgage or a second mortgage. Now, the statute 718.116 states that the association is only subject to the first mortgage on the property. So, if it is a second mortgage, the association is actually in the better position. It has a higher priority in the property over this second mortgage, which would mean that your attorney could file an answer and get the association dismissed from that foreclosure, which would mean that the association then would not be foreclosed by that second mortgagee. This is important because there are some title issues that are out there. There, for whatever reason in the past, some of these title companies have overlooked first mortgages that were not satisfied. So if those mortgages are still out there and there is not a recorded satisfaction, that mortgage is still a second mortgage on the property, and the association would not be subject to that second mortgage. The reason that you would like to file an answer in these mortgage foreclosure actions is you want to avoid a default judgment against the association. If there is no answer filed by any party, the mortgagee can go through the courts and request a default judgment. This basically says that they have not received any sort of response from that party. There are certain reasons that you would not want a default judgment, and the biggest is that you would want to be able to know what's going on in that case at all times. You want to know the beginning, you want to know when the sale occurs, and you want to know when a certificate of title is issued. As far as your collection rights, the default does not remove your collection rights. You would still be able to collect against this property, but a default judgment removes your ability to file any affirmative defenses. So in the case of it being a second mortgage, you would not be able to file a defense. You would not be able to go in front of the court at a motion for summary judgment and argue the association's rights. So it's important that you file an answer and let the judge know that you are being represented and that you want to protect the association's interests. It's a cost-benefit analysis for the association to determine if you want to move forward. Several clients of ours will contact me and say, but this person doesn't owe us any money at this time. I can almost guarantee you that if this person is going to go through the mortgage foreclosure, they will eventually stop paying assessments. If they believe that they can save the property, there is a chance that they will continue to collect. And it's likely that you can go ahead and be able to come to some sort of agreement with this person. However, if they are going to lose the property in mortgage foreclosure, at some point they will want to recoup what is left of their property and they will stop paying assessments. I have to tell you that if you do have a payment arrangement or some sort of agreement with the owner ahead of time, go ahead and continue to collect. Any monies that you collect during the pending mortgage foreclosure, the association gets to keep. So it's to your benefit to continue to collect against this person, but you want to avoid things like attorney's fees or anything that would be extra, such as filing a lien. We often have clients say, well, if we hurry up and file a lien against this property, will we be able to recoup our losses? Filing a lien against the property does not necessarily secure that money. What happens is, just as Paul touched on, the first mortgagee has the first priority to the property. So by having a lien, the only way that those assets are secured is if your lien is filed prior to the Liz pendens in the mortgage foreclosure and they fail to name the association as a party to the mortgage foreclosure action. That doesn't happen very often because normally these mortgagees make sure that they do title searches and check to see what liens are filed out there against the property. So I would encourage you that if this person, if they have money that's owed against the property, go ahead and continue to try to attempt to collect that, but I would not advise you to expend the court costs or attorney's fees to file a lien after you have a known mortgage foreclosure against the property. Now, if the association is not named in a mortgage foreclosure, which sometimes happens, like I said, if they fail to name the proper name of your association, or they name a wrong association, or if by some means they forget to name the association, that is to your benefit. Do not call it to the plaintiff's attorney's attention. The statute protects you and says that if the association is not named, you will be entitled to collect all past due assessments on the property. So if you know of a mortgage foreclosure action, again, alert your attorney so that they can follow up on this mortgage foreclosure action and continue to monitor it for you, but do not contact the plaintiff's attorney and tell them that they missed something, because that's their error and it's to your benefit. Now, a lot of the associations will ask, how long are these cases going to last? It used to be that many of them would be 3 to 6 months, and it would go from the complaint to the certificate of title before a year passed. Now we are seeing these cases, because the courts are so inundated with the numbers, these cases are lasting well over a year. That's hard for the association to swallow, because the statute only allows you to collect 6 months of past due assessments for limited liability of the plaintiffs. So unfortunately, staying on this and trying to wait it out or wait out the mortgage foreclosure is just not the solution at this point. A lot of the timing on it depends on the plaintiff's action, which, as we know, if these mortgagees have several mortgage foreclosures that they're trying to close, their offices are also being inundated with the numbers, and so the cases go slower. It also depends on the court's docket. It used to be that when I would go into the court, you'd see attorneys coming in with maybe 10 files. Now they're coming in with entire rolling crates full of files. They've been limited by the judges to only hear 12 cases before a judge per day, so now they're scheduling it with 4 judges in any given day so that they can come in with the maximum amount of foreclosures. And what's happening as well is, if there's any type of misstep by the association, or if the owner comes to the hearing, many times the judges are finding in favor of the owner as far as giving them a delay. They'll allow owners, it used to be 30 days between the time of the judgment and the time time of the sale. Now they're allowing anywhere from 60 to 120 days before they set the sale date. And at that time, if there's any indication that the owner is making any headway with the bank, or if they feel that the bank is stalling, sometimes they will allow the owner to delay it even more. So if this case stalls out, what does the association have that it can employ in order to move forward? Unfortunately, the plaintiff is the one who controls this case. They are the ones who are setting the timeline and determining when the hearings occur, determining when the sales occur. The one remedy that the association has is that if the case has stalled out for 10 months, you can file a notice of lack of prosecution with the court. Now, the court will give the plaintiff and any other party 60 days in order to file a paper or petition the judge to keep the case open. They can file anything. This includes an affidavit that says what is owed against the property. That's all they have to do to keep the case open. So the judges have been very lenient. This is in the plaintiff's favor. They can keep these cases open. And what many of them are doing is if there's any indication that the owner wants to make a deal, so basically anything other than a default, then the plaintiff will stall and see if they can come to an agreement with the owner, but they'll still keep that case open so that if the owner defaults, they don't have to start over. In a case, there's several important dates to note. When you receive the summons, the association has 20 days to file an answer without penalty. So what this means is there will be 20 days before the plaintiff can file anything against the association. That's not to say that if you are after that 20 days that you cannot still file an answer. As long as the association has not had a default judgment entered against it, you can still file an answer or request that the plaintiff's attorney give you an extension to file an answer. So even if you have mortgage foreclosures currently within your condos that you have not turned over to your attorney, I would recommend that you turn them over to them, because even if you're beyond that 20 days, there may still be a possibility for you to file an answer and have your voice heard in the case. The next important date is the hearing on the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. This hearing is when the plaintiff will go before the court and have all of its documents laid out to try and get its judgment perfected. The association, if it has any affirmative defenses, will want to appear at that hearing. Otherwise, if you have no defenses, then it's fine if you just go ahead and monitor the results of the hearing and see what the judgment has. Then at the hearing, they will set the sale date for the property. This is the mortgage foreclosure sale. It's usually held at 11 o'clock at the courthouse on the given day, and it's for any number of people to come in. If there are no purchasers, then the plaintiff is usually the one who purchases the mortgage back and purchases the property. After that, a certificate of sale is issued, and then the owner has a window of about 10 days to file any objections to the sale. For instance, if they file bankruptcy right before the sale or anything. And after that, the certificate of title would be recorded. Like I said, the courts have been moving much more slowly than they used to in the past. It used to be that after 10 days on the dot, they would file the certificate of title and it would be recorded. Now, however, it's taking even months for the certificate of title to be recorded. It's important that the association stay on top of that, because the actual transfer of property does not occur until that certificate of title is recorded. The other documents that are filed with the court are the motion for summary judgment and supporting affidavits, the original note and mortgage, and answers by other parties. These documents usually don't affect the association's position, but it is what you would find in the mortgage foreclosure documents. If you ever have any questions about the documents that the association receives, if you haven't turned them over to your attorney, you can always contact them and let them know. Sometimes you'll see a dismissal of party defendants. That usually dismisses the tenants and things things like that, but it won't affect the association's position. If the mortgage foreclosure is dismissed during the procedure, then the association may pick up its collection accounts right where it left off. There will be no effect as to what you can collect as far as interest, late fees, and attorney's fees. Just keep in mind that even though the mortgage foreclosure is dismissed, which means that the bank came to an agreement with the owner, it is possible that they will refile or petition the court to reopen that case. So it's a good idea to monitor that and make sure that the mortgage foreclosure action is fully dismissed. I touched on the certificate of sale versus the certificate of title, but I do want to stress that there is a difference. The certificate of sale is issued on the date of the sale. The certificate of title is issued 10 days after that, or even further, up to 30 days after that. The certificate of title is the actual transfer of title. So if you have banks or mortgagees who obtained the certificate of sale and they're trying to contact you to determine what amounts are owed, you need to tell them that you need a copy of the certificate of title to prove that they are the owner of the property. What's happening in many of these foreclosure actions is that although the plaintiffs are obtaining the certificate of sale, they are assigning their bids to a third party, such as Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or another bank. So you want to make sure that they have the title and that the title on the certificate of title, the name of the new owner, is the same as the name of the plaintiff. If they are different, this changes the amount of money that the association will be able to collect. Under the statute, plaintiffs are allowed to collect a minimum, or are required to pay the minimum of 6 months of assessments, or 1% of the original mortgage, whichever is less. If they assign their bid to a third party, that third party is required to pay all assessments. There is no limited liability. So you want to make sure that you have the correct name on the certificate of title so that you know what amounts you can collect from the new owner. Now, the assignment of bid is different than an assignment of mortgage. As we know, lately there have been mergers of banks, so that can affect how the certificate is issued. Perhaps between the time that the certificate of sale is issued and the certificate of title, there was a merger that affects who the bank is now. You'll want to make sure that you get the information that you understand that the bid is different than the title and go by the name that's on the title and the assigned mortgage. So when you go to collect from the bank, you need to determine the assessments that are now due. 718 statutory language calls for joint and several liability with the previous owner. Now this, if for third parties, will be all of the assessments, and for the plaintiffs, it will be that portion of 6 months or 1%. The key factor in both of these is that you must remove interest, late fees, and attorney fees, and administrative fees that occurred prior to the certificate of title. You will not be able to collect those from the new owner, and the new owner's assessments will come due the date the certificate of title was recorded. Attorney's fees used in the defense of the mortgage foreclosure action are not collectible from the owner. It's important that you understand this. There's a difference between attorney's fees used in the collection of the assessment and attorney's fees used in the defense of the mortgage foreclosure. Consider the attorney's fees used in the defense of the mortgage foreclosure as the association using its own money to protect its own interest in the property. So the association is going to have to spend this money from its own accounts. You cannot put that onto the collection account for that property. So that's a good thing that you need to keep in mind when you're trying to determine the cost-benefit analysis of whether you want to file an answer in these situations or not. Now that we've discussed the process of the mortgage foreclosure actions, I want to discuss some strategies that you can use to help prepare the association in these mortgage foreclosure matters. For condominium associations, the basic affirmative defense that you have to set forward is with a second mortgage. With a first mortgage, there really are no affirmative defenses that you can bring into play, but as I said before, with the second mortgages, you do have the priority over any second mortgagee. There is also a possibility for a cross claim. This is a relatively new concept as far as answering in the defense of the mortgage foreclosures, because it's based on the current economic conditions. If the owner attempts to secure a new mortgage, their lender may require them to satisfy all the judgments against them. This is what Paul was talking about, an in personam remedy. You are going after the owner in themselves and putting a personal judgment against the owner. But as Paul also said, this is more difficult to be able to collect in the end for the association. What you can do is file the cross claim against the co-party. Because this is in the mortgage foreclosure action and is dealing with the property, you can file this as part of your answer. Now, as far as service against that personal owner, if the owner has made an appearance in the case, then you can send it by certified mail return receipt requested, and that will cover the service. However, if the owner has not made an appearance, you will have to do personal service against this owner. So that requires getting a server and having someone go out and serve the person individually. Also, if the owner does not file an answer in the cross claim, you will have to do service by publication and request that the court have hearings to request that the court file a default judgment against that owner. You'll also have to show a good faith effort that you tried to locate the owner for personal service. Now, the judgment, when you obtain this judgment against the owner for the personal remedies, it will have to be recorded in the public record, and it'll also have to be recorded with the Division of Corporations. This is important so that you maintain the integrity of the judgment. Also, that judgment will have to be re-recorded every 7 years in order to collect against the owner. There is no guarantee that you will collect against the owner, but in the current market conditions, where many of these mortgagees are requiring extensive background checks on these owners before they're giving them new loans, this may provide you an opportunity to at least have a mark against that owner before they can buy another property or have another mortgage on the property. Now, once the bank or the new owner, whether it's a third party or the plaintiff, is issued the certificate of title, the association now has an immediate action against this property. You can begin collections immediately. You don't have to give a prior notice to the new owner. You can begin with your intent to lien letter. First, you have to determine the amounts owed, as we talked about before. And you can collect a prorated assessment for the monthly or semi-annual or annual dues. So for instance, if the owner has the property and the certificate of title was issued on November 13th, you can go ahead and collect assessments from November 13th forward, including the prorated amounts. You also may include postage fees in your intent to lien letter and administrative fees that occur after the certificate of title was issued. As I said before, anything prior to the certificate of title being issued, whether that's attorney's fees, interest, late fees, administrative fees, those must be removed. The new owner will not be responsible for those fees. You'll send the intent to lien letter to the plaintiff's attorney if the plaintiff was the one who took title, as well as the plaintiff's address that's listed on the certificate of title and the property. So there will be three different places that your letter will go to, and that must be sent certified return receipt requested and regular mail pursuant to the statute. This will proceed just as any regular collection. It's just that now you have an immediate action against this property. So if it's a third party, you will be able to collect all assessments against the property. If it is the plaintiff that now owns the property, you will be able to collect the lesser amount of 6 months of the past due assessment or 1% of the original mortgage. So you have an immediate remedy, and it's important that you take that and go as soon as you can so that you can start collecting those monies from that new owner. If the foreclosing lender fails to make payment, you will proceed against them just as you would any other collection. But the good news is now you have the first priority on the property. There is no one ahead of the association who you will have to take the property subject to. So you'll be able to foreclose, obtain the property, and resell it as the association. Beware of banks who try to delay payment. They may try to tell you that they do not owe any past due assessments, or they may try to tell you that they are waiting until they can sell the property. We all know how slowly the market is going and how long it takes to sell units in this current market. So do not let them delay by telling you that they do not have to pay until a new owner takes title. That is false. Even though you may be contacted for an estoppel request for a new owner, that you can go ahead and proceed with, but the bank does not have to wait until there is a new owner on the property. They are responsible for payment of not only the past due assessments, but all assessments that accrue after the certificate of title is issued. So my recommendation to you is act swiftly and go ahead and talk with your attorney about the best ways to go against these mortgagees and be able to obtain the assessments that are due to the association. And with that, I'm going to turn the floor to Helena Malko, and she can discuss the other collections and lien foreclosures.
I'm not Helena.
Will you be moving?
Yeah. I'll just leave this here for the time being.
Yeah. You have a talking?
Yeah, but I'm going to talk first, so just when we're done, well, and then you can put this on.
Okay. After you, then I'll be back.
Right. I'll be just a couple of minutes. Just a couple of comments on what Erin had to say, and Helena has a couple also, and then she'll give her presentation. On this... Whatever I said. Okay. A couple of comments. On the issue of the cross-claim, as Erin said, there's been a whole new change. You know, before this whole crisis hit, you could go out and get a no verification, no statement account in mortgage. You wouldn't have to tell them basically anything but your name and social security number. They wouldn't check your credit. They wouldn't verify your income. None of that stuff. But now, with this crisis, they have basically said, show us all your birthmarks. And one of the things that we're seeing these lenders do is to say, we're going to do a full credit history. Oh, you've got a judgment against you. If you want this loan, you will have to pay that judgment. So that's the reason for going forward and spending a little money now, getting a money judgment against the person and recording it and keeping it valid. You can do it for up to 20 years. If somebody ever wants to go and get another mortgage, there's a real good possibility that they're going to be told they won't get it if they don't pay you off. So that's the investment you make by doing the cross claim now. The other thing that I want to make clear is that because you are in a second priority position, if there is a second mortgage holder, and if there is any possibility that there's equity in the property, then it is possible that a second mortgage holder is going to come along and pay you off and pay off the first mortgage in order to protect their interests. Because if they don't do something, they essentially get wiped out and get bupkis. So there's a real possibility that that can occur too, but only if there's some equity in the property that would justify the second mortgagee paying off everybody ahead of them. Okay? And then a couple of very quick responses here on questions that we've received so far. I think you heard the answer to this one, but I want to emphasize it. How can an association recover funds in excess of the maximum of 6 months that must be paid by banks? The answer is unless they are not the first, the holder of the mortgage or a first mortgage, in which case you can collect the full amount, then you are only limited to the lesser of that 6 months or 1% under current law. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit later about some possible changes to that that may come into play if you help us get it done. And then I think that's the only other one I want to respond to, except for this one. This was a co-op. Somebody gave me a quote from the Co-op Act, which is, in fact, is not a quote from the Co-op Act. And it says, each month we transfer funds from money to reserves. The amount that we ever budgeted, the state statute says, and it supposedly says that we pay within 30 days of their deposit. He calls to my attention the within 30 days of their deposit. My question is, if we did not collect from some owners, could we not transfer that portion until we collect the fees? The answer is no. The statute doesn't say that. In fact, the administrative rules simply say that you must fully fund the reserves unless properly waived, and you must deposit the money as frequently as you collect it. Okay? But the point is that you must fully fund. If you don't fund because someone didn't pay, that is in essence a reduction in the funding of reserves, which requires a prior membership vote. Let me now turn it over to Helena. To Harry. This is not Helena either.
Here's the difference. I just wanted to say that we are recording this. We will produce a DVD. I doubt if any of you can remember everything that you've heard so far, and we're not through. If you want a copy of the DVD, we will make enough to satisfy the demand for them. Don't know what it will cost yet. It possibly will cost about $15, but that'll be a wonderful way to have a record of what was said this morning and to review it, because these DVDs turn out to be of excellent quality. So we will end up asking you, if you want one, to get in touch with Roger Kesselbeck, with the man in the white suit back there. In any event, they will be available, so think about that one. Excuse me.
Thank you. I am Helena, this time. Thank you. And together I make Paulina. We've been referred to as Paulina.
Isn't that special? I'm going to touch it in. And then I'm going to put this on your back.
Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
I just wanted to touch upon what Aaron had said. Oh, I'm sorry. I'll stop that. Good? All right. I just wanted to touch upon what Aaron had said with regards to the bank foreclosing and then they ultimately taking title. I think it is extremely important, because of the different variables on what their liability is, that you in fact consult with your attorney about what the liability is. You know, like Aaron mentioned, is it a second mortgage? Who took title? Was it in fact the plaintiff? Was it an assigner of the plaintiff? And all these different variables change what the association can collect. And at this point, you want to collect the maximum amount possible. And what I'm seeing is a lot of title companies are, you know, contacting the association directly and saying, this is what the liability is. And it's not necessarily true or accurate, because they have the goal of making the bank pay less so that the sale goes through. So it's very important, I can't stress that enough, that when you get a copy of a certificate of title, that you consult with your attorney to make sure that you're collecting everything that you're entitled to from the bank. Now, unfortunately, in this scenario, when you're seeing such a high volume of bank foreclosures, a lot of banks are taking title to the property, and unfortunately, they're not quick to pay. So it's not like before, where you had previously the bank taking title and then they pay you, because the statute requires that they pay within 30 days of the transfer of title. Now they're not paying for months. So you're going to have to take collection action against the bank. And like Aaron said, it's a good thing, because they've wiped out their priority. There's no mortgage on the property, and you can actually take the property away from them and have property free and clear of any encumbrance. So, but the bad thing is that you're going to have to force the issue. They're not voluntarily paying because of the huge inventory of homes that they have acquired within the last year or so. And unfortunately, I'm not sure what the solution is to stave off these mortgage foreclosures. I don't see it turning around for probably maybe a year or two. So I think the association really has to pay attention to its collections, and that's my task. What do you do prior to being informed of a mortgage foreclosure? What is the collection process? Now, the statute was recently changed July 1st of 08 to impose a little bit more of a standard with regards to notices. instead of one notice being required, now there are two notices that are required. The first notice that is required is the notice of intent to lien. The statute requires that this be a 30-day notice of intent to lien. In that notice, you're notifying the owner of the assessments that are owed and the association's intent that if they do not pay those amounts, that they will move forward with a lien. Now, the statute indicates that this notice has to be sent out both certified and regular mail to the unit address as well as to any alternate mailing address that the owner has given to you. This is important because what I'm seeing is sometimes when the accounts get turned over to me, the association has sent out the 30-day notice of intent to lien, but it has been not sent to both addresses. Now, the law doesn't necessarily have reason, and I know that sometimes the condo unit is vacant. So why send notice to a vacant property? Unfortunately, the statute doesn't speak to that. What it is still imposing is that you do send notice to the unit address as well as to the alternate mailing address. Those two places, it has to be sent out both certified and regular mail. If you turn it over and it has not been sent to both places properly as required by statute, then you're not going to be in a position to move forward with the placement of a lien. Now, I think that the association has an ability to do the notice of intent to lien. It's not required to be done by an attorney. And I recommend that the association be the one that first sends out a notice of delinquency to the past due owner. When an attorney sends it out first, you've already gotten on a bad foot with the owner because they're saying, I've never received any prior notice from the association. This is the first I've heard of it, and now I'm responsible for attorney's fees. Your goal always is to get paid. Okay, and so I think for the association, go ahead, send out that notice of intent to lien. You include the interest, the late fees, any other administrative fee that that your documents allow, and you give them 30 days to pay. Now, because of the statutory change imposing this 30-day notice of intent to lien, you're going to have to consider what your past history is with regards to late notices, because by adding this statutory change, you're kind of lengthening the process of collections. Because, for instance, if you're routinely sending out a 10-day late notice, then you send out a 30-day late notice, and then now you're at the point that the owner has not responded to you, then you're going to be having to send the 30-day notice of intent to lien. So right now, you're already looking at least 2 to 3 months that the owner is past due. And also, too, again, your goal is to get paid. It's easier for an owner to pay $200 versus $600. So the sooner you present the debt to the owner, the more likelihood you are to get paid on that debt. So what we're recommending is that with regards to late notices, and that's a courtesy. The statute doesn't require late notices. So say, for instance, your documents say that the assessments are due on the first day of the month. By 10 days in, they haven't paid it. Go ahead and send out the courtesy late notice. If they don't pay after that late notice, and it's now 30 days, I would recommend to you that at that point, go ahead and send out the certified regular mail 30-day notice of intent to lien. Because at the expiration of that 30-day period, the owner will only be behind 2 months. Okay? So again, you have to send out that certified regular mail notice of intent to lien before you can record a lien. Now, once that period expires, the owner hasn't contacted you, then you go ahead and turn the account over to the attorney who will then prepare the lien to be recorded against the condominium unit. Now, the lien has to be done by an attorney. The reason being is because you're going to place an encumbrance on a unit. You have to make sure that the legal description is correct, that you've named the right owner, because you don't want to slander someone's title by slapping a lien on an incorrect person or property. So I would recommend that you allow the attorney to handle that. They will undertake the owner's ownership search to make sure who owns it. And on that note, if it's in fact owned by multiple individuals, say I own it with my husband, the notices that are sent, specifically the notice of intent to lien by the association, has to be addressed to both parties. You cannot only send it to Helena, because maybe I'm not talking to my husband, and so I don't share that notice with him. So if there are multiple owners, your notices have to be properly addressed to all the owners. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Mr. and Mrs. Smith and their son, Joe Smith. So please be careful when sending out the notices, not only with regards to the addresses that are being used, but who you're sending the notices to. Okay, and it has to be the legal owner of that property. And as part of the association records, you should have a copy of the warranty deed of record detailing to you who the owner is. Now going back, once the account is turned over to the attorney and a lien is placed, the attorney then has to send out a second 30-day notice. This time the attorney's letter is saying to the owner that now you have 30 days or the association intends to foreclose the lien that's being recorded against your property. It's a 30-day notice of intent to foreclose lien. The statute also requires this notice. This was the only required notice prior to the statutory change, so it's now changed to two notices. So you have a 30-day notice of intent to foreclose the lien. That notice will include a copy of the lien to the owner saying this has been recorded or it's going to be recorded. And after the expiration of that 30-day window, then you can move forward with the lien foreclosure process. So that's your pre-collection. You have to send out the notice of intent to lien and then turn the account over to the attorney who will do the lien and then send out the second 30-day notice of intent to foreclose the lien. Now the statute says that if this second notice isn't done and the association proceeds with the filing of a lawsuit, you're not going to be able to collect your attorney's fees. And that's not a good thing. Okay. And one thing also, too, with regards to mortgage foreclosures and the attorney's fees incurred in filing an answer and keeping up with the process of the mortgage foreclosure, those attorney's fees, like Aaron said, are not collectible. Unlike collections, in which the statute provides specifically that the association's claim of lien not only secures the unpaid assessments, but interest, cost, and attorney's fees. That's why you're in a position to recover the attorney's fees incurred incident to the collection of the assessments, because the statute specifically gives you that right. There's no right or no statement in the statute that says any attorney's fees that you incur in the defense of a mortgage foreclosure action is collectible. It's not. So the attorney's fees and collections are because of the statutory language and that the lien secures that. Now, what is a lien foreclosure process? What is that, or a lien foreclosure action? Essentially, it takes the same course as a mortgage foreclosure. The bank, through its process, is foreclosing its mortgage. The lien foreclosure, the association is foreclosing its lien rights. Okay, and it starts also just like a mortgage foreclosure. The association's attorney prepares a complaint. That complaint is demanding the assessments, interest, costs, and attorney's fees incurred to date. And it names the owners of the property as well as any second mortgage holders. Again, we reiterate that the association's lien is only trumped by a first mortgage. So if there are second mortgages, and in this market, unlike any other market, there are two and three mortgages on units, because there has been, you know, over 100% financing on some of these units. So it's important that the attorney review the public records, determine what other encumbrances are on the property, and name those inferior interests so that when the association perhaps ultimately takes title, they have foreclosed on those inferior interests. So the complaint names the owner, all the secondary interest holders. And then that whole packet is filed with the court and then gets served on the owner and the other named defendants. Now, this process, like Aaron said, is also been delayed because of the court's calendar or just the sheer volume of cases. And it doesn't happen overnight.
Okay, you would want to think that once the attorney files the complaint, foreclosure, and what the association takes title. That doesn't happen. Where I'm seeing the biggest delay in the process is trying to locate the owner. Some of the owners are not at the property, and they live perhaps overseas or perhaps in different parts of the states. And they live in Nebraska or they live in California. And so it takes time to locate the owner because the court would want us to personally serve that paperwork. So they knock on the door, they hand deliver that paperwork so that there's no question that the person is put on notice of the court case that has been filed against them. Now, in some cases, the process server goes out, does many attempts to try to locate the owner, and the owner's nowhere to be found. Now, the judgment call is on the process server because they have to represent to the court through an affidavit of due diligence that they have searched all the public records, done skip traces to try to locate that particular owner. And if all those efforts have failed, then the law provides that you can obtain service through publication. So all is not lost if you cannot find the owner. But again, there's going to be a delay because that process server has to make sure, because they're representing to the court, that they've taken several steps to try to locate that owner. Okay? So let's say it's an easy case. The owner is in the unit. The process server knocks on the door and hands delivers that complaint to that owner. From that point, once the owner is served, they have 20 days to file an answer to the court. Now, what I see in most cases is that the owner does not respond. Okay, they have no defense. They know that they haven't paid. They're behind. Okay, and so they don't respond. That 20-day time frame goes by. No answer is filed with the court, and then now the association moves forward with a default with the court. It's called a motion for default, and what you're representing to the court is the owner has been served, the affidavits of service have been filed with the court, and they haven't responded, and you're entitled to entry of a default. When you get that entry of the default, the association is now in a position to move forward rather quickly to get judgment against the owner. And how that is achieved is that the attorney will prepare a motion for final summary judgment, again, attesting to all that is owed. And along with that motion, you're going to file some respective affidavits. One affidavit that's executed by the association is an affidavit of indebtedness. The association signs it. Attached to that affidavit is a complete itemization of all that is owed to the association, all the assessments. Okay. Once the association attorney gets that affidavit of indebtedness executed and an affidavit of cost, and then the association's attorney also has to do an affidavit of reasonable fees and an affidavit of attorney's time. Because what you're saying to the court is the owner has not filed an answer, there are absolutely no defenses, and we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So many times you're going to get paperwork from the attorney, and what I'm trying to explain to you is what you'll be receiving. You'll get a motion for summary judgment attached with all these affidavits, and it's really just very simple. You have to explain to the court what is owed. That's contained in the affidavit of indebtedness. The affidavit of cost is all the costs incurred by the attorney in bringing the action. And then there's an itemization by the attorney of their time, what all has been done to prosecute this case and the cost related to that service. And then the file gets reviewed by a local attorney who will attest to the reasonableness of the attorney's fees. Once that whole packet is gotten together and filed, then a hearing on the association's motion can be heard. Now, the statute or the administrative rules requires that once that motion for summary judgment is filed, a hearing cannot take place no sooner than 20 days. But what we're seeing is that 20-day is not really met. There's no problem because the court docket is putting out the hearing for at least 2 to 3 months. before you get a hearing. So again, the process gets a little bit extended depending on the court docket. Once the hearing takes place and the court determines that there are no defenses that have been raised, you get a judgment for everything that is owed to you. That judgment will provide for the setting of a foreclosure sale, just like the bank. Okay, and that's typically set about 30 days from the date of the entry of the judgment. So say, for instance, you get a judgment entered in favor of the association on January 1st. February 1st, there's going to be a foreclosure sale of that property. Foreclosure sale is very simple. It's a public auction at the courthouse steps or in a courthouse room. Okay, and there are bidders. The association starts the bid at a minimum of $100. It's not actual $100 that you have to show and give. It's just a nominal figure. And the reason you bid at $100 is to minimize the tax liability of your bid. But say, for instance, you bid $100, you start with $100, and someone comes in $120, okay, and no one else bids. Then that party takes it at $120. So it goes to the highest bidder. What we're seeing, unfortunately, is that the association is taking title. There are no other bidders there. So the association walks away with a unit. Now, again, I would like to reiterate that if there is a first mortgage on the property, the association has absolutely no liability to pay on that mortgage, unless you want to, perhaps it's a good location, you want to use it for some other association purpose, and you'd like to purchase it. Okay, so the association would then perhaps contact the bank to try to work out some deal with regards to paying off the mortgage. And what the association takes title to is subject to the first mortgage. What that means is simply that if and when the owner stops paying on the mortgage, then the bank can start its own foreclosure process and take the property away from the association. Now, during the time that the association owns the unit, you could try to rent it or try to sell it, subject to making sure that at the time of closing that the proceeds are enough to cover any existing first mortgage balance on the mortgage. But because of the fact that the mortgage foreclosure actions are taking so long, close to a year, you're going to have some time to be able to perhaps rent it out and recoup some of the cost and some of the balances that are owed on this particular account. Okay, so that is the nuts and bolts of a lien foreclosure action. The whole process typically takes about 4 to 6 months. Again, the delay is if, in fact, at the very beginning, the owner can't be found. And then the process server is the one that's going to make all these efforts to try to locate that owner. So the goal is for the association to act quickly before a mortgage foreclosure action is filed. Because what we recommend, and some attorneys differ, but our firm takes the position that once the mortgage foreclosure action is filed, the association should put collections on hold. The reason being is you're already owed money, and perhaps in some cases a substantial amount of money. If the attorney continues with collections, there's going to be more cost and attorney's fees added to that debt, which is not likely to be recovered if, in fact, the mortgage foreclosure proceeds and concludes in the bank taking title. So why add more to the uncollectible debt? Because as Aaron explained, if the bank takes title, the only liability that they have is a portion of the past due assessments. It doesn't matter that you're owed interest, costs, and attorney's fees. They're not liable for that. So our recommendation is, why waste your money? Employ it for another collection that perhaps the owner doesn't have a mortgage or is not that far behind. Use your money wisely, and in this time, you have limited funds, so you need to prioritize the use of your money. So that's why we take the position is if it goes into mortgage foreclosure, let's put a halt on collections. Let's not add to your debt. Okay? Now, one of the things that is happening is that I see, and it's hard to explain, is Under the statute, the condominium lien is only valid for 1 year. Okay? And the statute requires that within that 1 year, you have to file the lien foreclosure action to preserve that lien. There is a common misconception that you can just simply refile and renew the lien. That is not the case. The lien is filed, it's valid for only a year, and if that year goes by and whatever amount is on that lien, say it's $500 because it covers from January to March of a particular year, and that 1 year goes by, no lien foreclosure action has been filed, that $500 is no longer secured by a lien. Okay, it becomes a debt out there that, yes, you are entitled to collect, but there's no collateral, no security. You cannot simply refile a new lien. If you do file a new lien, it would start from April forward. You have lost those 3 months. That's why I'm not a particular fan of accelerating assessments. Some documents in the statute does allow for acceleration of assessments. That means if an owner is past due for X amount of days, then the whole rest of the year is collectible and part of a lien. I don't recommend that because, say, for instance, you put the whole year on the lien and the 1 year goes by. Now you've lost a whole year of assessments. So you have to be careful. It is a right that you have to accelerate assessments, but you have to be very vigilant when enforcing your lien. You cannot allow that 1 year to expire or you've lost more money. Okay? Now, my point is, with this 1 year expiration, because these mortgage foreclosures are taking a long time, and perhaps you've put the collections on hold, that 1 year may come up. So what does the association do? Okay? And it's really a judgment call for the board of directors. Do you think, what is the likelihood that the bank is going to ultimately foreclose and take title? If perhaps you've spoken to the owner, they're saying, definitely I'm walking away, then you may not want to file a lien foreclosure to protect that lien, okay? If you think that the likelihood that they're going to foreclose. Now, if you think that perhaps the owner has entered into a repayment plan, I would go ahead and recommend that you do file the lien foreclosure action to preserve your lien. Now, keep in mind that when you file the lien foreclosure action, although your lien secures all these costs and attorney's fees in filing the action, again, at any point in time, because if there's an existing mortgage foreclosure, that bank can move forward and foreclose, and the costs that you've incurred in filing the lawsuit are not recoverable. So it's a catch-22, because if you allow the lien to expire, those amounts are no longer secured by a lien, and you've lost the ability essentially to collect it, because most owners don't have additional property that you can levy against to collect that amount. So again, it's a judgment call. What do you do? And so that's the one issue that I'm faced with presenting to my client, to say the 1 year is coming up. What do you want to do? And what I'm seeing is most of my clients just do go ahead and file the lien foreclosure action. We don't do anything. We don't serve it. We just file it to preserve the lien and then just monitor the outcome of the mortgage foreclosure. The good thing is that if the mortgage foreclosure action is dismissed, you're already in a position to move forward and you started your own foreclosure case. Okay, but if the bank forecloses, you'll just simply have to dismiss that case. The reason it's a judgment call, again, is because if you do not file the lien foreclosure action and the bank ultimately dismisses the case and the 1 year has gone by, those amounts will not be recoverable. Okay, so more and more that issue is coming up because of the fact that the mortgage foreclosure is taking a very long time. Okay? So my strategies for you, those are part of the handout, and I'm sorry that not everybody got a handout. We made 150, and graciously, you've all come in droves, so that's a great thing, but we don't have enough for everybody, but I just wanted to recap it for you. This is a falls first in the association's ball, in the association's court. You need to first familiarize yourself with what's contained in your governing documents as to collections. There's normally a very prominent assessment article which tells you what your lien rights are. But contained in that particular assessment article is what interest you can charge on a past due account, when interest starts to accrue, and if late fees can be charged. Now, on this point, a lot of associations start to impose late fees when the documents do not provide for late fees. You may not charge late fees if your documents don't say you can charge late fees. Okay? If your documents don't provide for late fees, you can certainly amend either your declaration of condominium or your bylaws to provide the imposition of late fees. So be careful, because you cannot collect the late fees if your documents don't provide. And if an account gets turned over to our office and you've charged late fees, I will wipe them out, because it's an improper debt that I'm then attempting to collect. And also, I know that some associations have been fined by the division, not so much recently, but fined by the Division of Florida Land Sales and Condominium because of improperly charging late fees. Okay, so be careful. And it's an easy thing to do to amend your documents to provide for late fees. So familiarize your, or perhaps not, but familiarize yourself with your documents so that you send out the notice of intent to lien properly, including what interest and if late fees can be charged. Now, again, this is very important. Prepare a collection policy. I think you get more compliance with information. What is the association going to do to me if I do not pay my assessments? That's what the purpose of the collection policy is. The collection policy will provide the number of late notices to be sent. Okay, and like we previously stated, we suggest perhaps one late notice as a courtesy, maybe 10 to 15 days after the due date of the assessment, and then the second notice be the 30-day notice of intent to lien. But again, this is crafted by the board of directors. What collection policy you want to put in place? Again, the collection policy is going to restate what's in your documents. Tell the owners, we're going to charge you 18% on your past due balance. On top of that, we're going to charge you a $25 late fee if you don't pay. And then also, too, when the account is going to be turned over to the attorney, the policy should state that. And that way, you eliminate any subjectivity. This is an objective standard that applies to every owner. Because a lot of times when I get an account, the owner says, oh, the board doesn't like me. They're not doing this to anybody else. And you could say, pull out your collection policy and say, this, Joe, applies to everybody. You may not like the board president, or they might not like you, but we're following this standard. Okay? Now, again, the policy should also touch upon payment plans. What type of an agreement, if an owner comes to you and honestly says, I've really fallen on bad times, my wife has lost her job, I've lost my job, we don't have any money really, we have a minimal amount that we can contribute to this debt. Again, your goal is to get paid. And Aaron touched upon, you know, if in fact they're in mortgage foreclosure and they approach you for a payment plan, I would seriously consider entering into a payment plan. Some money is better than no money. Now, it doesn't mean that you can give them 2 years, 5 years to pay. Make it reasonable. We normally suggest to our clients that a payment plan not exceed 6 months. But again, the board has the flexibility to say, depending on the circumstances, what term is feasible and likely for that owner to comply with. But again, the collection policy should provide a contemplation of what the association would consider with regards to payment plans. Then what I recommend is once that is prepared by the association, that that gets sent out and distributed to all the members, so that they know exactly what is expected of them and what will happen if, in fact, they become past due, what interest, late fees, that they're going to start incurring attorney's fees after the 30-day notice of intent to lien because the association intends to move forward with a lien. Okay? Put everybody on notice. I think with information, you get more compliance. Very key is that the association, be it through the treasurer or through your particular management company, you need to carefully monitor your receivables. You're more likely to collect less of a debt than you are if they're $10,000 behind. Not everybody has a spare $10,000 that they can send over to you. So minimal debt, 100, you know, if they're 1 month behind, 2 months behind, you need to start paying particular attention as to what's going to happen to that account. Also, too, you may want to, again, this is on the same guise of giving information. If you have a community newsletter, put that information. We have X amount of receivables. We're owed $20,000. Please, though, do not name anybody. Do not. I know that's a good tactic. Nobody wants to see their name on the newsletter, but no scarlet lettering. You cannot do that. Okay, so just give a figure. Or say, of 100, out of 100 accounts, 52 are behind. Okay, just give them the information. Okay, and also make a statement that if the association does want to consider payment plans, that the owner should contact and put the contact person, be it the board president, the treasurer, perhaps the particular manager that's managing your community. Give them a point of contact to try to work something out. So give that information in your newsletter. Also, too, if your documents provide for screening upon purchase, use that to make sure, double check references. What's their financial record? What has it been? So you might be one a little bit more critical now in accepting purchasers that perhaps have a bad past of a financial record. Because if they've had a difficult time in the past and in this market, they're going to come in with condo dues due monthly and perhaps special assessments being imposed to cover shortfalls. You're putting in someone in that may not be able to maintain and pay timely. So again, this is a critical point early in the process to minimize what the past due owners will be. So use that screening process. However, if your documents do not provide for screening in a prior approval of purchasers, then you cannot conduct that. You would have to amend your documents to give you the right to pre-approve purchasers. And provide for screening, and that amendment should specifically provide what actually is going to be part of the screening process. Okay? This is pre-turnover to the attorney. This is what the association can do to minimize collections. The most important one of these, I think, is a collection policy. Set an objective standard, disseminate it amongst all your owners so everybody knows what is required. Now, once the account is turned over and the attorney starts forward with perhaps a lien or the lien foreclosure action, give that attorney all information that comes or you become aware of. If they're renting the unit, if they've walked away, if a mortgage foreclosure action has been filed, because this will impact the collection process. Because the association, through this statute, once you file a lien foreclosure action in conjunction with that, you can start demanding rent from the owner and the tenants during this process. You could say you send out a demand to both the owners and the tenants and say, the owner is past due, all rents now have to be sent to us during this process. And they sure. What the statute allows for is that if a unit is being rented When you file the lien foreclosure action, as part of that process, you can demand that the rents that the owner is collecting on that unit be sent to the attorney to be put in trust or to be deposited in the court registry during the pendency of the lien foreclosure action. That's a very powerful tool because you're cutting off the income to the owner. So they're collecting money on their unit, but they're not paying you. Once you file the lien foreclosure action, that is a remedy that the statute gives to you. In a recent case, I was filing on behalf of an association. I filed 5 lien foreclosures at one time. 4 of the units were being rented. Luckily for me, we sent out the demand. 2 of the tenants voluntarily paid. They're remitting the rents directly to the association. So that's a good thing, because you were going to get the owner's attention rather quickly. Now, you might, most of the time you have to force the issue, but that is a good remedy available to the association. So again, give that information to the attorney so that they know. The attorney's not going to know if there's a renter or not. So that's up to critical information that you need to give to the attorney. Now, collections is a hot issue, so I think you really need to sit down with your board and determine what approach the association is going to take. I think it has to be a proactive approach, and because you're going to find yourself not being able to operate your community because you're going to have a shortfall in your budget. And one of the items that we touch upon is that the board in drafting up and preparing and calculating your budget figures has to really take a critical eye as to what percentage of receivables you're going to have. So if you need $200,000 to operate and you have a 10% or 20% receivable, you need to adjust that figure within the confines of the statute and your documents to make sure that you do, in fact, ultimately collect the $200,000. If you don't provide yourself with a shortfall and there is receivables, you're not going to collect the $200,000. So you're already starting behind the eight ball. So we're trying to give you some strategies so that you minimize the collections, minimize the accounts that are turned over to the attorney, because you're going to be starting incurring attorney's fees on that. And you know what you need to do, particularly with mortgage foreclosure. Again, I mean, Aaron gets 8 to 10 a day. That's a scary amount. I've been doing this for 16 years, and I've never seen the volume that I'm seeing today. And, you know, that only affects the association because you're not going to collect all the past due assessments. You're only going to collect a very limited portion. Yes, sir.
Would you be kind enough to, I know that we're doing questions after.
Sure.
I think this is a really important point.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be kind enough to restate the parameters in which we can have the rents sent directly to the association and mm-hmm. what statute that is so that we can mm-hmm. apply that to our...
Sure. The statute that governs assessments is 718.116. The question was, what are the parameters that the association has to abide by to exercise the remedy of obtaining rents from owners? That was the question. And where is that authority found? The authority statutorily is found under section 718.116. Okay, that you can demand rents from an owner. Now, you cannot, as an association, do that without first filing the lien foreclosure action.
Thank you.
Okay, you have to file the lien foreclosure action first. And in conjunction with that, you simultaneously send out the complaint to be served on the owner, and you also mail out, by certified regular mail, the attorney would do this, to demand the rents from the owner and the tenants. Okay? That's the parameters. It has to be done when a lien foreclosure action is filed. It cannot be done prior to that. So the best bet is the same time that the lien foreclosure action is filed, you send out that notice of demand for rents. Yes, in the back. Okay. Well, if they're not paying rents, you can't collect the rents. I'm sorry? Okay. I'm being told to hold off on questions. Sorry.
All right.
We're happy to answer all your questions. We just have one final segment, which is important because Paul works very actively with the Florida Legislative Alliance to try to put in place good legislative strategies to assist associations. And I think you need to be involved in that process because good legislation at this time will give more remedies available to an association in collections. All right?
I'm going to take only a couple of minutes. She mentioned the Florida Legislative Alliance. Our next meeting on February the 20th, we're going to have six speakers from the Florida Legislative Alliance. So it's quite a good panel discussion to discuss the remaining economic issues. I want to tell you that Monday we will have the handout posted on our website. You can download it from there. Our website is spacecoastcondo.com. So you can do that Monday. Also, I told you to find the man in the white suit and tell him that you wanted a DVD, if that's the case. You can also send him an email, and his email address is rk-scca@cfl.rr.com. rk-scca@cfl.rr.com. Okay, another thing I didn't mention earlier is that we're going to have elections at our next meeting. And this time we're going to send out, mail out proxies as well as get a vote at the meeting if we need that. We have to have 20% of all of our members respond in order to have a legal election. The next President's Forum is February the 14th, the usual place. And with that, I'll turn it over to Paul.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, I need a break. No, you don't need a break. I don't get one, you don't get one. Okay, most of the questions that we've gotten so far relate to rentals, and I'm going to cover that in some greater detail. There is one that's only tangentially related that I'm going to respond to rather quickly, and that is somebody has given me one that says that an owner wants a complete list of all the delinquents and all those cases that are with the attorneys, including the name of the owners. Can we give it to them? The answer is not without redacting the name of the owner. The statute was amended by our good friend, Representative Julio Rabina, last year to say that there is an exception to the official records that includes Social Security numbers, credit cards, and, quote, any other personal identifying information of any person. Now, if you can tell me what that means, good luck. But clearly a name is personal identifying information. Perhaps a unit address is too, but my recommendation is you clearly delete from your list of delinquents before you hand it out the names of the owners. Otherwise, you're going to be violating this and perhaps violating federal privacy law as well. Okay. They don't. Well, first of all, they're not condominium associations, are they? This is a statute relating to the official records of the condominium association. That's you, not a newspaper. Okay, now, let me turn to the issue of rentals. A couple of things I want to say about that. First of all, I want to read you the statute that governs this. This is found in section 718.116, parentheses 6C. If the unit owner remains in possession of the unit after a foreclosure judgment, now here we're talking about the association's foreclosure judgment, has been entered, the court, in its discretion, doesn't mean it has to, may require the unit owner to pay a reasonable rental for the unit. Now, if the unit is rented or leased during the pendency of the foreclosure action, again, the association's foreclosure action, the association is entitled to the appointment of a receiver to collect the rent. The expenses of the receiver shall be paid by the party which did not prevail in the foreclosure action. Now, anyone who thinks you're going to get a receiver to collect a month's rent is crazy. What we normally do is seek to have the money sequestered with the registry of the court, and they take a 10% fee. Now, that means adding the tenant as a party if you have to go to litigation to do this. And as Helena said, this statute applies only once the foreclosure has commenced. So what I'm going to start talking about in a few minutes is how do we get that rent without having to commence a foreclosure. A couple of other points that I wanted to just cover. With regard to the cross-claim, Helena said that your recovery of attorney's fees in the foreclosure action, the mortgage foreclosure action, is not recoverable, and that's true. However, if you file that cross-claim against the owner, hoping to get that money judgment and then maybe collect the money judgment later, the attorney's fees that you incur in filing the cross-claim judgment are collectible as part of the judgment. Number two, the timing for filing lien action versus mortgage foreclosure. I agree that once the mortgage foreclosure begins, we generally will not recommend that you continue your own lien foreclosure action. However, you have to have a big caveat. If it's going, if you're pretty far advanced in that in your lien foreclosure action, and the mortgagee is just starting, and if we know their track record is such that they take a long time to complete the foreclosures, we may well tell you to go ahead, complete the foreclosure, get the unit, and use it for the next year or so while the mortgagee completes its own action. We want you to have an opportunity to recover that money. You may be able to do it by renting it, or you may be able to sell your interest. You've just bought the $150,000 unit for a bid of $3,500. Now, you may be able to convince somebody that this unit is worth $3,500, and they can then pay you the $3,500, buy your interest, they become the unit owner, and can do whatever they want. Go refinance it, pay off the mortgage, and rent it for the next year if they want to and collect those rents. This is simply some leverage in some property that you have that will allow you perhaps to recover your money. So while we generally don't recommend you proceed with your own collection activity once the mortgage foreclosure has started, we have to caveat that by looking at the specific facts in each case. And clearly, whether the unit is rentable and what condition it's in is one of those issues that you have to look at. Next, the association lien life and its recoverability. Helena kept saying, and is correct, that if you record a lien and don't commence that foreclosure within 1 year, you effectively lose the ability to recover the money shown on that lien. That's true. But remember when I talked at the beginning, there are two remedies, the in personam and the in rem. What you lose if by failing to file that mortgage foreclosure action within 1 year of recording the lien is the in rem remedy, the ability to go after the property. You can still, in theory, get a money judgment against the owner for that money that was due, covered by the original lien, and which you failed to act on within 1 year. But your chances of recovering that in your own foreclosure action are probably slim and none. So while it is recoverable, it's probably not, you're just going to get a piece of paper for it, and that's all. The adoption of the collection policy, a very good point. Number one, treat this as rule adoption. That means you notice a board meeting 14 days in advance to all owners with a copy of the proposed policy and adopt it as a rule. The unit owners would have a right to come and have input on this policy. Now, what is the basis, what is the reason that you really want to have this policy? Helena mentioned good information to the owners. I'll mention one other one, board credibility and veracity. If you tell your owners in advance what you are going to do if they do not pay, and then follow through on that policy, you will be showing the members that you are trustable, that you have made a commitment, and that you're going to follow through on that commitment. That will tell owners that I can't screw around with you, that I have to either deal with you, or I can't expect you to just kind of let it go. And that's important, because in order to collect the money, what we want you to do is minimize the amount you are owed. The less that you are owed, the greater your chances are of recovering it. So if you tell people exactly what you're going to do, and you then carry forward, you have maintained the board's credibility on that issue. Okay, now, let me turn to my portion of the presentation. And I'm going to try to give you some ideas, maybe one earth-shattering idea, but some just operational type information, and then perhaps some legislative information that will try to give you some strategies for minimizing collections before you have to talk to Helena or before you have to talk to Aaron. Although, to a large extent, talking to Aaron is out of our control. That is what an owner does with their own mortgagee. But I will say this to you. The question of when somebody is delinquent with you, what you should do is act quickly. Aside from the fact that you are going to minimize the amount that you're trying to collect, what I always say, and I know I've said it in this forum before, we are lawyers, not magicians. I can't make you do something, quit smoking or whatever. I can't do it by hypnosis. What I have to do, and what Helena tries to do, is force you to make a decision if you are the delinquent owner. You have to ask yourself two questions. Number one, do I want this property? Number two, can I afford this property? You have to have that talk with yourself at the earliest possible moment. And so what we do by having Helena start the collections process, you're now telling an owner, we're coming after you, and may ultimately result in you losing your property. The owner then has that conversation with themselves. If they answer either of those questions in the negative, what are they going to do? They're going to stop paying their mortgage, because they will perceive that as throwing good money after bad. That your action in starting the collection will ultimately result in a visit with Aaron, because now the person who has answered both those questions in the negative will stop paying the mortgage. That may precipitate the mortgage foreclosure. Okay? They may not ask themselves that question for quite a while, in which case we may, as I said earlier, suggest that you complete your own foreclosure because you're way ahead of the bank. So that's what we want you to do, is act quickly, because you have that advantage over a bank that is consolidated and is now sitting someplace in on the West Coast or even out of the country. So that's the way we want you to proceed, and that's the reason for the collections policy. Now, let's talk about some internal operating strategies that you folks can deal with. First, budgeting and assessment considerations. Let me just see a show of hands here. How many of your delinquency rates are over 10%? How many of you know? Don't know. Okay. How many of you over 20%? Anybody? I guess you're all current. Okay, well, that's good. End of discussion. Okay. Well, now, the point is this. If you have a 10% delinquency, then when you start your budgeting process for the year, you should be building in that 10% delinquency. The problem that associations see is that if they need $100,000 to run, they adopt a budget with $100,000 in it, and then if they 10% delinquency hits, they have only $90,000. If you put in a line item for bad debt for 10% of what you need, now your budget goes to $110,000, and if 10% don't pay, you collect $100,000, and guess what? You have enough to operate. So build in bad debt if it's a historical problem for your community. It should be a line item in the budget. Okay, you can then wipe out the bad debt, and that's how you proceed. So, you know, at this point in time, you should be building a little fat in there if you've got a collections problem. Now, people may perceive this as increasing their assessments, but in fact, if history, and your budget is nothing more than a prognostication, and if history bears you out, you will collect exactly what you need and no more. Okay, another issue, reserves. I want to point out a couple of things about reserves, and I had a question here. I think I've already answered it with regard to funding. You must fully fund the reserves, even if the owners don't pay it. You're obligated to fund it unless you take a vote of the members to waive or reduce it. Now, it's very tempting for me to recommend to you that if you're in tough straits that you go ahead and waive or reduce reserves. I'm not going to do that. I think that reserves are an asset. I think it's essential for you to fund them, and I'm not going to recommend that you not fund them. However, I am going to recommend that you be prudent about how you determine your reserves. For example, use of a reserve study is a good idea because it may lead you to a pooled reserve system where you have a layout of what expenditures you're going to need to make to maintain your assets over a period of time. That may allow you to use some of those reserves or spread them out over a longer period of time. It never hurts to get expert advice, and in this kind of an environment, frankly, I think a reserve study is a fairly good investment of your money if you haven't had one done. Another thing that the administrative rules and the statute allow you to do is to reclassify your assets to avoid the requirement for unnecessary reserves. The example that is contained in the division's rules is this. If you have two pools, swimming pools, and the cost of replacing them or doing deferred maintenance is $6,000 a pool, if you classify them as two pools, then that's $12,000. You meet the $10,000 limit and you are required to fund a pool reserve. However, you are within your rights to also classify them as two separate and distinct assets. The value of each one or the cost of each one being $6,000, each one separately is under the $10,000 limit and you do not have to have a pool reserve. Is that clear? Okay, so you can do that with other assets. In addition, the statute allows you to look back every year at what maintenance you have done to your assets, the reserved assets, and you can adjust your reserve requirements based on any extension of useful life. Again, that's an issue that a reserve study can help you with because it will tell you when you do maintenance how much longer you can expect that asset to last. If you then adjust your reserve funds, any extra money can be used for operating expenses instead of reserves. Waiver reduction, I've already discussed. I really don't want to see you do it, but I do want to encourage you to create something that looks like a reserve that most people think of as a reserve, but that isn't a reserve. If you look at the administrative rules, there is a definition of what a reserve is, 61B-22.001 to be exact. The definition of a reserve is any fund that is restricted as to use. Well, you know, we have funds in our operating account, but they're not restricted as to use. We can actually use the money that's earmarked for landscaping to do something else, to pay the phone bill. And that's not a problem. So if you create an unrestricted contingency that you fund, you have that money that you can use for any necessary purpose. And if you don't use it by the end of the year, you can put it into reserves, thereby reducing next year's funding requirement, or you can refund that unrestricted contingency and fund it again in your subsequent year's budgets. So I'm encouraging you not only to put in a bad debt line item, I am encouraging you to put in an unrestricted contingency fund to meet unforeseen expenses. And those are operating in nature, not reserve funds. Let me wait on this. 61B. That is the chapter of the Florida Administrative Code. If you want to Google Florida Administrative Code, you'll be brought to a website. If you put in Chapter 61B, those are the regulations, the administrative regulations of the Division of Florida Land Sales, Condominiums, and Mobile Homes, and the chapters that you want are 61B-22 is where the financial aspects of condo regulations are found. Okay, acceleration considerations. As Helena said, you do have the ability to accelerate funds. I also am a little cautious about using accelerated funds. Hold on a second, we have an urgent message here. Please explain the new Fannie Mae lending requirements. Oh, okay. Oh, when is that, 8 minutes? Okay. Just start waving frantically, and I'll shut up for a minute. Okay. Acceleration. I want to say this. I don't have as big a problem with accelerating if you do it carefully. My problem with accelerating is that I'm afraid you're going to wind up losing the money, particularly in a mortgage foreclosure situation, when you accelerate a whole year's worth of assessments. If you accelerate too early in the year, I'm a bit concerned that that's likely to happen. If you accelerate in the second half of the year, by the time the foreclosure is commenced and all that, there's probably little chance that that is going to make a big difference. And then when I talk about an issue that I want to talk about in a few minutes, about perhaps a way of putting some money aside ahead of time to anticipate these things, acceleration may become more attractive to you. But I'll get back to that in a moment. A couple of other considerations. Screening of new owners. Helena mentioned it. Be selective in who you take. Screening of tenants. This is a really major issue. And a lot of you on the coast don't have the ability to screen tenants. And if you don't, I'm sorry for you, because we have a statute. This was another one that our friends put in, that is found in Section 718.110, parentheses 13, which says that any amendment that you attempt to adopt that restricts an owner's right to rent is not effective as to that owner unless they consent to it. And of course, it has to be passed by the requisite approval. So if we get 2/3, but this owner just didn't vote on it, he's not bound by it until he sells his unit or until he separately consents. Now, that's a problem, because I'm going to tell you there are some real advantages in terms of collecting monies if you have the ability to screen and approve tenants. But a lot of the coastal properties have provisions in there that specifically say that while you may get a copy of the lease and while there's a minimum rental period, you specifically do not have the right to screen tenants. So good luck changing that. But I think in this kind of an economic condition, you have a chance of at least binding the majority of owners if you can pass that amendment. There may be some who aren't going to be bound by it, but I'd rather take half a loaf than no loaf. And the reason that I think that this is important is this. With the right type of amendment in there, if you have screening authority, then you have the ability to refuse to allow an owner to rent if they are delinquent. That's a very powerful tool. You can say, I don't care, you know, that you want to rent and this is your brother-in-law, you can't put him in there if you're delinquent. You can't say that, though, unless your documents permit you to screen. Very important. I would encourage you to think seriously about putting that kind of authority or attempting to put it into your documents. Number two, and you can limit the screening authority to only looking to see whether the owner is delinquent or not. If the owner is delinquent, then the answer is we have the ability to say no. If the owner isn't delinquent, then we don't have any other purpose to say anything but yes.
Garnish rents to pay back due?
I'm going to talk about that. The answer is you can't garnish them, no. But you wouldn't want to, but there may be a solution here. Recently, I saw a set of documents that gave me pause, and then I tried to figure out how to use them, and I want to just tell you basically what the documents said. It said, in this situation, if you are a tenant, and if your owner becomes delinquent, your tenancy is automatically terminated. Now, my initial thought, and I still believe it, is that that probably is not a valid provision. Because think about it. You've got an innocent tenant sitting in the unit, and suddenly, through no fault of his own, he's being told, you got to get out. That works a forfeiture that I don't think a court would countenance. Okay. We also have a principle that says that you don't have any remedies in terms of collecting assessments that aren't in the Condominium Act. And so I got a question about whether we could turn off the cable. The answer is no. Okay. You do not have an ability to deny utilities, turn off the water, turn off the electricity, turn off the cable, because there's nothing in the statute that allows you to do that. However, in this situation where it says to the tenant, your tenancy is terminated if your owner becomes delinquent, I said, you know something, I'm just going to take that at face value. And what I do is I wrote the tenant a letter. And of course, I copied the owner. And I said, here's the provision in our documents. My client is willing to waive your termination if you'll just agree to remit your rent to us. Okay? And that's what happened. Now, that may cause a problem for that tenant with his unit owner. That unit owner may say, hey, I'm going to evict you. You're not paying me the rent anymore. Well, I don't know. But the point is that if the owner doesn't allow us to keep the money, then that owner is just going to wind up facing a foreclosure on his unit. So, I like... Nope. I've been officially gagged. I'm going to pick up with exactly the word I was at.
I'll take the opportunity. I misspoke about the date of our next meeting. It's the 28th, not the 20th of February. You will get notices out.
Folks, I'm on that important issue of rentals. So, anyway, if you have this provision in there, and if you then send a demand to the tenant, because it gives you cover, even though this provision may not be valid, someone's going to have to challenge it before it's determined to be invalid. So, if you can put a provision in your documents with your owner's consent. And I would stress this. I don't think that a provision that is put in by an amendment that tells where the rent goes in the event of a delinquency, I don't think that restricts an owner's right to rent. He has the right to rent. He just may not have the right to get the money. And so I would argue that an amendment like that does not require each owner to consent to it under 718.110 subparagraph 13. So this is one of those things that I'm urging you to think seriously about, is to put in some provision in your documents that says, in the event of an owner's delinquency, the rent is ours. Okay? And then if that tenant leases, you have the right to approve. He's got to sign your application. He agrees to be bound by the declaration. The owner has already agreed to be bound by the fact that he bought the unit. Now I think what you do is you're saying, hey, we have a basis for writing you before suit. and saying the owner's delinquent, send us your rent, and we'll give you, we'll take it, and then we will waive your default on the owner's part and give you the money back when you're current. So I think that's a very significant strategy I want to commend to you. While we were changing the tape, I had one question about Chapter 720 HOAs and asked me about the differences. Sir, I'm going to define those for you in 1 minute. And the answer is the process for the mortgage foreclosure situation is identical, number one. Number two, you are not automatically in a second position. Number three, the time frame for foreclosure, instead of 30-day notices of intent to foreclose and intent to lien, require 45-day notices of intent to foreclose and intent to lien. Number four, you don't have any statutory right to recover rents. So if you wanted to get that, you would have to put it into your documents. Okay? And that would be pretty hard because most HOAs do not have a right to screen and approve tenants. So you'd have to know it was rented, and you'd have to say in there, we have a right to do something, and then you'd have to find out information about who the tenant is. And then the other significant issue that I will get to is preservation of abandoned property. So that's your HOA, and hope you got something out of that. Okay. Now, getting back to this, another strategy I want to commend to you is creating other sources of income. Now, I know this may be kind of difficult in the communities that you folks are in, but there is a provision that prevents municipalities from restricting access to beach access through your owners, your tenants, and your invitees. Perhaps your association may want to open your beach access to people on some days and charge them for the privilege of coming through. I mentioned bake sales, and I'm not completely, you know, unserious about that. You also, if you have clubhouses or other amenities that might be used for social events, you might want to think about renting those out. But I caution you that if you open them to the public, there are situations where you may have problems with your insurance coverage, and you may have to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act in terms of modifying the premises. But if you have amenities, you may be able to make some money. My thought goes to a homeowners association that we represent where they had ball fields and they were allowing the public to use those ball fields. Charge rent. Another thing that you may have if you've got a clubhouse with any kind of facilities, you may want to think about bringing people in to provide classes, dancing, tennis instruction, aerobics. Those people like to make money. You may want to charge your owners for those classes and split the money with the person who's doing the instructing. Now, there are some liability issues there too, but it is a potential source of income. So look at your assets and determine whether or not you can use those to make money. A popular misconception is that because you are a corporation not-for-profit, that you can't turn a profit. That is wrong. A corporation not-for-profit is a Florida designation. It simply means you can't pay dividends to your owners, and you can't distribute your net income directly to your members either. Other than that, you can make money. Any money that you make that isn't through assessments will be taxed more severely than any assessment income, but it's still money that you can add to your coffers. Another thing that we've seen is if you have a newsletter, selling advertising in your newsletter is not a bad way of making a few bucks also. So there are things that you can do, but before you do them, I want to urge you to talk to your counsel before you engage in them, because you may need extra coverage or waivers of liability or something like that. Another thing that I want to talk about and this is where maybe I've hit upon something, and this is your bolt of lightning, as it were. I want to read you something out of the Condo Act, and maybe you can tell me what it means, because I've been puzzling it over it for years. This is found in Section 718.111, parentheses 4. And it's titled Assessments, Management of Common Elements. The association has the power to make and collect assessments and to lease, maintain, repair, and replace the common elements or association property. Let's stop there. If you've got any boating stuff, I hope that you're leasing those boat slips out to your owners. You may want to think about increasing that rent from something nominal to something substantial. However, the association may not charge a use fee against the unit owner for the use of common elements or association property unless otherwise provided in the declaration of condominium or by a majority vote of the association, or unless the charges relate to expenses incurred by an owner having exclusive use of the common elements or association property. The key phrase for me is that we may not charge a use fee without a majority vote of the members. Well, you know something? Oftentimes your documents require a lot more than that to amend them. 2/3, 75%. What's a majority? It's not that bad. Supposing we adopted an amendment or we adopted a use fee by a majority vote of the owners, and that use fee was something like this. We're going to ask every owner to deposit with the association $1,000 for the use of the common elements to be held by the association in escrow until and if the owner becomes delinquent in the payment of assessments, in which event we will dip into that money to pay for use of the common elements. Okay, there's your bolt of lightning. Now, I talked to John Pete about this. John Pete is the senior financial analyst of the Division of Florida Land Sales. He admitted nobody had ever asked him that one before. He also said that he didn't know the answer of whether that would be permissible. But he did say it would be appropriate to file a petition for declaratory statement and get an answer from the division on this. I would suggest to you there's nothing in the statute that I can find that prohibits this. And so since it only requires a concurrence of a majority of the members, this is my suggestion. In effect, a way to require prepayment of assessments, a deposit, to be used as a use fee contingent upon the owner becoming delinquent. And when I move and I've never been delinquent, I get my money back. Okay, but this may be a, without a statutory change that specifically says we're going to be able to prepay assessments like this, this may be a way for you to do it. Okay, so I want to urge you to do that. I'm going to get a flood of calls, and all these attorneys are saying, who told you this? Have them give me a call. It's not set in stone that you can do this, but this, when I tried to focus on the issues here and what strategies, this is one that came to mind, and I want to give it to you, and let's hope that it's valid. Okay? Can I repeat that, garbage or verbiage? Okay. All right. The verbiage from the statute.
Just look it up in the statute.
Well, the statute is 718.111(4), and it says that we can charge a use fee for use of the common elements if approved by a majority of the owners. I am suggesting that a fee, you collect money from the owners, whatever amount it's going to be, as a use fee for the common elements for to be used if and when the owner becomes delinquent in assessments. Period. Yeah, Beverly, go ahead. Yes, I just wanted to take Beverly's because I know hers is going to be of applicability to this. Go ahead.
Well, should you do that and you're keeping $1,000 from each member, I assume you would keep it in
you're going to keep it in an escrow account somewhere. If you touch that money, you're in trouble.
And when I sell my unit, am I
entitled to Well, I think that's something that probably ought to be dealt with in whatever way you do it. But, yeah, I think it's appropriate to pay interest on that, you know, passbook interest for that period. And so that's the kind of thing that I would be thinking about doing if I were drafting some sort of a use fee like this. Okay, let me go on and let me finish, and then I'll take the questions. I mean, we'll have plenty of time for questions. Okay. I'm just going to briefly mention and refer to the fact that you may be able to borrow money I mean, you know, they always say that a lender is somebody who will give you an umbrella on a sunny day. They don't like to give you stuff when you need it. It's only when you don't need it that they like to give it to you. But, you know, these banks have money. There are some people out there who are adept at lending to associations, and it may be a viable means for you to ride out a bad situation. However, I caution you that one of the things these lenders look at is your receivables situation. So if you've got bad receivables, they're probably not going to lend to you. But if you're in a position of trying, you get owners who are stretched and you can keep the receivable situation down, borrowing may be a basis for you to take money and then stretch it out and pay it back over a realistic period of time with interest, but at a smaller incremental rate. Okay, let me turn to the other issue, which is this, legislative help. I've talked about what kind of internal stuff you might be able to do. Now I want to talk about the external stuff. As we've talked about, both HOAs, and I'm going to give you the 720 on this, and the 718. 718 we've talked about says that if you have a mortgage foreclosure, and the person or some person who owned the mortgage requires title, and it's a first mortgage, they only have to pay you the lesser of 1% of the original mortgage amount, $1,000 in the case of a $100,000 mortgage, or 6 months of assessments, whichever is less. In an HOA, that figure as of this year is the lesser of 12 months assessments or 1% of the original principal mortgage amount. So it's difference of 6 months. We also know that the banks have gotten themselves in a lot of trouble, and they've dipped into the public till in a fairly substantial way to be bailed out. And if you read the media, you're hearing that they're not lending that money. So the question is, what do we do about the banks? As a person who does this stuff legislatively, I can tell you that several years ago, there was an attempt to take that 1% and dial it up to 5%. And the bank's lobbyists essentially said, if you do that, not only will you not get the 5%, we'll take away the 1%. Yeah. This may be the year to do something about it, because I don't think anybody wants to listen to banks. Do you? Okay, so what we've seen is a lot of talk about let's change the situation. And in fact, I can tell you that in Daytona Beach Shores and in the city of Miami, for example, or maybe it was Miami Beach, the local municipal authorities have passed resolutions asking the legislature to provide greater support from lenders to associations in a foreclosure situation. And I would urge all of you to think about asking your local government to do that kind of thing also. Now, I've seen the resolution that was passed in Daytona Beach Shores, and it's rather short on detail. And when I look at the bills that have been pre-filed, I only find one that actually addresses this issue, and it happens to be the CAI-FLA FLA bill. And what we have proposed is this. We don't want to say the banks are completely responsible for all back assessments, because if we do that, they may say we're going to take our money and go elsewhere. We won't lend to anybody who wants to buy a condo. And what does that do for you in terms of trying to sell your unit? What does it do for the industry? It doesn't do good things. But what we've done is we've dialed up the number, and we've said the bank's responsible for 12 months of assessments, or the lesser of 12 months assessments, or 20% of the original principal mortgage amount. But if they don't pay what they owe within 30 days of acquiring title, they owe it all. So I think that's a fair solution. And if I can urge you to do anything today, it is to personally contact your legislators. This is Senate Bill 880 in the Florida Senate. Please ask them to support that bill, and in particular, that section. Because if you have any time or any prayer of beating the banks, this is the year it's going to happen. Okay? So this would really help you, because if the banks delay, and Aaron and Helena both talked about the fact that they're delaying, and Helena said that if they don't pay, you just treat them like any other unit owner and lien them and foreclose. I would love to be able to say you're going to get that more realistic figure, and also if they don't pay it in a timely fashion, you're going to get the whole ball of wax. So it's really important, I think, that we do that. Now, part and parcel with that is another question that is coming up with great frequency, and that is, what do we do about these properties that are being abandoned or trashed? And this particularly relates to 720 HOAs. And I can give you a couple of answers to that. My county, where I live, Orange County, has been remarkably good about that. If there is a code violation, they will come out and maintain the property. They cut the lawn, they'll drain the pool, that sort of thing, because it's a public health issue. And yes, it's costing them a lot of money. And that's prompting the counties in turn to say, hey, let's do something about this. And the proposals that I have seen from the local counties and municipalities involve requiring lenders to start maintaining property at the time they commence foreclosure. Now, I have also written a bill that I gave to Senator Evelyn Lynn that took a slightly different tact, and that is allow the association to perform certain maintenance. And if they perform certain maintenance, like draining swimming pools or stopping leaks in condo units or plugging holes and boarding windows, that kind of thing, that they should be given a priority and effectively paid out of the proceeds of the foreclosure before the foreclosing lender. So that's a proposal that's out there too, but I haven't seen it filed as any type of a bill. But I got to tell you that you need to talk with your local municipality about what they will do in the event of abandoned properties. I would venture to say that HOAs have the advantage here because it's more visually obvious. In a condo, I think you've got to be more proactive. Your units, the association has a right, an irrevocable right of access. You need to go into the units. You need to make sure that the air conditioners are run periodically, that the water is turned off or secured so that the pipes don't break and you don't wind up with water intrusion issues all over the place. And in a situation I recently had, I had a woman who had been gone from her unit for some time. She was the subject of a mortgage foreclosure. She showed up and asked the manager to turn the water back on, and the manager called me. There was a mortgage foreclosure scheduled 2 days away, and I said, no, don't turn the water back on. What I was afraid of was this person was going to trash the unit in that period of time. And so they didn't turn it on. She turned out to satisfy the mortgage foreclosure. It was canceled. The sale was canceled. At that point, I said, turn the water back on. But I think you've got to take that kind of step. And if she wants to sue, that's fine. She can sue for 2 days of being out of her unit. But I think it was better to do that in that situation than to allow her in there with God knows what motivation. So I think that you have to be pretty proactive as an association in terms of securing these units when they are abandoned. And of course, I urge you, if people, as they do, abandon pets in these properties, don't just put them out. Take them to a shelter, preferably a no-kill shelter. We've actually done that ourselves, where we've been called by managers and said, there's a dog on the porch. I've had my vet take care of those pets, and I paid for that myself. So, you know, this is a real humanitarian crisis. I hope that we've given you some help in terms of how, a perspective of what it's about, and also some help in how to handle these things. And now I think we'll turn to questions. Okay? Let me start with the ones I've got, then I'll pass this on down the line. And I think these here all go together, so I'm going to read them all together. Prior to foreclosing on a unit owner, can the association enter into an agreement with the unit owner to pay their rent, to rent their unit? Paying current month's dues plus 1 month's rent, delinquent fees are paid, and the excess retained by the unit owner. If the unit owner agreed to that, that's great. I wouldn't necessarily want the association to be the one that rents it. I'd rather have the owner rent it and the association just collect the rent. What are the advantages of a 90-day lease requirement in place of a 30-day lease requirement? Answer, more rent. Okay? I mean, I don't want to have to go after rent and have the person move out in a month. It's just not economical. On the other hand, if it's rented for a year, I know there's going to be a source of income. What if the foreclosed property is being rented by the mortgage holder or owner? Can the association collect fees from the rental income? I think that we've already answered that. The answer is yes. Once you start a foreclosure action, you can ask the court to order the rent sequestered. And if you have something in your documents that allows the association to declare a default, you can tell the owner in advance that we will waive your default if you pay us your rent. Let me see here. What action can be taken against landlords who rent their condos and are delinquent in their maintenance fees? If you have the ability to screen, you can tell them you can't rent. If you have the ability, if they already have the tenant in there, once you start the lien foreclosure, you can ask for the rent to be sequestered. So all of these things are about rent. I think everybody acknowledges the fact that this is a really good potential strategy, and I'm just merely suggesting that in addition to what the statute permits once the suit is filed, a couple of amendments to your documents, which don't impair the ability of the owner to rent, but may impair his ability to keep the rent if he's delinquent, would be in order to allow you to try to get that rent before you actually have to file suit. Let's see. This one's completely not on point, but I'll answer it quickly. I've been told by an insurance agent that the law regulating owners to carry insurance is not, I can't read this word, owners can self-insure. The answer is no, they can't. You have to have insurance. Associations can self-insure, but the owners cannot. Let's see. Okay, my bolt of lightning strategy. This one I haven't read before. Okay. Okay. Please supply information on how and where and how to do reserve studies. There are a number of firms that do them. You can go online to CAI online. I'm sure Harry has information on reserve study groups. I know a few, and they specialize in coming out, analyzing your assets, and giving you a schedule for maintenance of those assets, anticipated costs, and anticipated life and prolonged life if you do the scheduled maintenance. Once you do that, that's the first step of taking a vote to have pooled reserves instead of straight line reserves. So that is something that a lot of associations have already done. I am merely suggesting that the pool reserves may lessen the burden of having to fund everything at once on a straight line method. My bolt of lightning strategy. My thoughts on charging a use fee for downstairs units who have used common elements for creating patios outside their back doors. Oh, boy. Well, you shouldn't have allowed them to do that. And there is a case that says that you have a 5-year statute of limitations to make them stop doing it. If after that 5 years has passed, you now try to come to them and say you're going to pay us for the use of this, I think you're probably going to lose. The other thing is that this is apparently aimed only at downstairs owners, not at the upstairs owners. And the idea here is you want to get something that's applicable to everybody. So think of a better strategy. Okay. Okay, you have some over there? Okay. Let me turn back to Helena and to Aaron. And even after we're done, we'll stay here and answer some questions.
I'll just click on there.
I'll just click this up here.
Behind the button? Yes. Oh, thank you.
Sorry.
Very good. All right. Okay.
Okay, a few questions here. The first, what happens when an owner provides a bank a deed in lieu of foreclosure? If this happens, this is generally before the judgment or before the sale. If the deed provides you with a deed in lieu of foreclosure, the same rules apply as a certificate of title. So the bank is allowed that limited liability of being responsible for only up to 6 months or 1% of the assessments. However, if the owner sells the property to a third party, then that is considered a regular sale, just like any other sale. They're responsible for all assessments, all late fees, all interest, all attorney's fees that have accrued on the unit up until that time. The mortgage foreclosure judgment does not have any effect on that sale if it's to a third party. But the deed in lieu of foreclosure acts just like a certificate of title with the limited liability for the bank. All right, the next question is asking if you can secure special assessments that accrue. And I would say that this depends on when the special assessment is enacted and how it is collected. If the collection of the special assessment occurs within that 6 months prior to the certificate of title being issued, then yes, you can go ahead and collect that special assessment. That includes special assessments that are enacted for budget shortfalls. So if it falls within that timeline of the 6 months, then yes. If you have something that falls before that 6 month timeline, it depends on how you collect it from the owners. If you allow them to collect, to pay that on a monthly basis, and that monthly basis comes within the past 6 months before the certificate of title, then you can go ahead and collect those amounts that come due during that time. However, if you have one lump sum that comes due on January 1st, and I'm trying to collect from the bank on August 1st, then if you required that to be due on January 1st for the entire amount, that will not fall within that 6 months that you're able to collect. So it depends on how you collect it from your owners and when it's enacted. The next question, how does an HOA or board of directors find out if an owner is late in mortgage payments? The only way that you can do this other than communication with your owners is to check the public records. If you have an owner who is delinquent, you can check the public records. Many of them have their documents in the official records online, and you're going to look for a Liz Pendens. This Liz Pendens, as I was talking about when you get the mortgage foreclosure complaint, has to be recorded in the public record. So the Liz Pendens will be able to tell you if the owner is in a mortgage foreclosure action. Other than that, it's communication and, you know, maintaining that contact with your owners. Right. You cannot ask the owners directly, though, because of the violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So you must be aware that releasing any type of information, and that goes, too, with owners who are in mortgage foreclosure. If a bank tries to call you, you have to be very aware that you have to have the owner's permission, and up until the certificate of title, the owner is still the owner of the property, even if the bank has a judgment. So be very careful as to who you are giving any financial information to, because you don't want to violate the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Also, the question, can a board of directors forgive a unit owner's past due indebtedness? Not when it has to do with assessments. The statute 718 is very clear that all owners have to pay the equal amount of assessments. You cannot forgive an owner's indebtedness for assessments. You can forgive late fees. You can forgive interest because those are discretionary, but you cannot forgive an owner's assessments. The next question involves mortgage balances that are well in excess of the current resale values. We know that there are a lot of upside-down mortgages, as they're called. Can the condo board foreclose on their assessment lien, forcing the sale of the unit to the first mortgagee, and would this force the first mortgagee to bid his interest in the condo's foreclosure? No. The first mortgagee has the first right to the property. If the association decides to foreclose its lien, the mortgagee is not subject to that action. They do not have to pay the associate, or they do not have to bid at the sale in order to get the property back from the association. All right. Upon receiving a foreclosure complaint from a first mortgage holder, describe the conditions which would cause an association not to file an answer. I would recommend that you always file an answer, because we were talking about having the notice. First of all, that's the most important thing that you can do for your association, is give your attorney and give the association the opportunity to respond to these actions and make sure that you are aware of all of the steps that are going on in the actions. What you can do if you decide that you do not want to file an answer because you think that this will move quickly, or you think that the owner is going to resolve the mortgage foreclosure action before it comes an issue, you can file a notice of appearance. This will take less time for the attorney, so it will likely cost you less than attorney's fees. Filing a notice of appearance tells the court that you are aware of the action and you want to be notified of all future pleadings, but it gives you less power than an answer, because the answer allows you to determine, to put forth like the affirmative defenses. You also want to make sure that your attorney is able to look at the foreclosure action, because then you will know if it's a first or second mortgage and what your rights are when they fall under that. So I would always recommend that you at least give your attorney the opportunity to look at the action and evaluate whether you should file an answer. But you can talk with your individual counsel if you think that your association does not have the financial means to file an answer, and talk with your counsel to see if that is a good alternative, just to file a notice of appearance. One more thing that I wanted to reiterate is that you should contact your attorney whenever you receive any information about estoppel requests that are pursuant to a sale on the property, whether this is the bank reselling the property or an owner reselling the property. Because we've talked about today, it's difficult sometimes to determine exactly what amounts are owed. It's important that you turn that over to your attorney so that you collect exactly the amounts that are owed to the association and you don't violate the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And as we've said, and I couldn't stress this enough, just be diligent. It's unfortunate when we get these mortgage foreclosures and only to find out that these owners owe thousands of dollars in assessments that weren't being prior collected by the association. So it's very important to stay on top of that. Also, it's important to maintain contact with your attorney and tell them of any changes that happen on that property, whether it's physical changes, whether it's ownership changes, because sometimes these the plaintiff's attorneys are so inundated with their own mortgage foreclosure actions that they do not file the appropriate dismissals when the property is sold in the meantime. So it's important that you let your attorney know, because since we are not on the property and since you're our only point of contact, you're the only way that we're going to know whether we should be continuing to follow up on those mortgage foreclosure actions or whether they've been resolved.
We only have about 5 minutes, but like Paul indicated, we're happy to stay after and answer any questions that perhaps we didn't get to. So please just give a little, have a little patience, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. One of the questions that was posed was with regards to the new Fannie Mae lending guidelines and how it affects the association. What this statute says, and Fannie Mae is mimicking Freddie Mac lending requirements, and essentially what it says is that in order for Fannie Mae to lend to a particular owner, they're going to strictly evaluate the association's financial position. They're going to determine whether the association's budget is adequate, whether the budget contains a minimum of 10% of annual revenues for the association's reserves, and whether there was available funds to cover the deductible for the master insurance policy. And I think the hardest one in this economic situation is that there's no more than 15% of past due assessments. So I think the other categories with regards to reserve and having an adequate budget, I think the association is going to meet that and with the insurance. But you might have less lending, at least by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, if there is a high percentage of receivables. Okay, so I hope I addressed that. Those are the four major points with regards to the new Fannie Mae lending guidelines. Mm-hmm. I got two questions with regards to the cost of proceeding with a lien foreclosure action. And roughly, it's about $1,500 in attorney's fees. Obviously, it all depends on your attorney and their hourly rate. But on average, it's about 8 hours of time, 8 to 9 hours, and roughly about $1,500. Now, the cost, in addition to the attorney's fees, is probably about $500. The filing fee, just to file the complaint in the respective counties, has gone up. The filing fee is $300. Now, on top of that, effective July 1st of this year, there is an additional $10 for issuance of each summons on a defendant. So, for instance, if the unit is owned by husband and wife, we also name unknown tenant 1 and 2, the filing fee would be $340, plus a $5 recording fee for the list pendants. So you're looking at roughly close to $400 just to file the case. And then there's a foreclosure report that's about $85, that's additional cost, and the service fees, that's all dependent also too on the process server, roughly about $150. So you're looking at probably $2,500. Soup to nuts with regards to the cost and the attorney's fees in prosecuting a lien foreclosure action. We got a question with regards to what about using legal aid lawyers? They're not going to be available to a corporation because the association is a corporation and you probably have sufficient funds. There is normally a minimum financial criteria that they evaluate to determine whether or not you qualify for legal aid. It's a thought, but not likely to be available to a corporation.
They're more likely to be defending the owner.
We're having this issue frequently as well. It's a very good question with regards to deceased unit owners. What are your options there? The first thing is if the association is notified of an opening of a probate case, that means that a person that left a will and that there is a personal representative that's opening a probate case to liquidate the decedent's assets. In that case, when you're notified, you should contact your attorney because what you need to do is file in that probate case a statement of claim. And what that is simply is notifying the probate and the court that there is a debt owed to the association. And before, more than likely, if there was available assets, before that probate case can be closed, the association's debt needs to be paid. If by chance they're the heirs and they're not paying the association, then you can file a case against the estate, name the heirs, and file the same lien foreclosure action that you would do with regards to any other owner. But your first bet is to file, when you're notified of the probate case, is to file a statement of claim and have something of record that the association is claiming a debt against this particular estate. They're asking, if payment is due on the 1st of the month but not late until the 15th of the month, when does 30 days start from the 1st or the 15th? I'm assuming that you're asking for purposes of the 30-day time period for the notice of intent to lien or intent to foreclose the lien. The 30-day begins to run from the date of the receipt of the notice by that owner. That's when the 30-day begins to run.
I don't think you can send it.
Right. You can't. What Paul's indicating, that is correct. If the assessments are not delinquent until the 15th of the month, you would not be in a position to send out the notice of intent to lien until the 15th, because that's when they're considered to be late. Okay? The 30 days would begin to run once you mail the letter. That's when the 30-day runs. It's from the date of the receipt of the letter by the owner. Yes?
Date of receipt or sending?
No, date of receipt.
So the point is this.
And that's why when you send it certified mail, and if they don't pick it up, then you go by the first date that they attempted to.
You were saying two different things.
I'm sorry.
The point is this. If you're going to do a collections policy, and you're going to send any kind of reminder notice, do it in the period
Do it in the period before they are delinquent. If you've got a 15-day grace period in your documents, send that reminder notice at the fifth day or sixth day, and then that way you've used that time period to good advantage, and then once they are quote-unquote delinquent after the grace period, now you can immediately send them a notice of intent to lien. So I would recommend that all reminders or past due notices go during that period. Maybe it's 15, maybe it's 30 days.
One final question that I'm going to take is, I'm assuming they're asking, when the association takes title, what is the association's liability towards payment of property taxes, mortgages as liens? We've already addressed the mortgage situation. You would not be responsible to pay the mortgage. With regards to property taxes, technically you will be liable for payment of the property taxes. However, I don't think you have to make payment right away. There is a period of time in which you can delay to see if, in fact, the mortgage foreclosure action commences. And I would wait really until you're notified that in fact a tax deed sale is going to occur. The taxes become delinquent, there's a certificate sold, and then within a period of time, then that person that holds that certificate can ask for a tax sale. 2 years. At that point, then the property is going to be sold. If the association owns it still during that time, then at that point you might want to consider whether you want to keep it for and just pay the taxes. You're going to have that opportunity because as a record holder, a record owner of that property, you're going to be notified of that tax sale. So yes, technically you're going to be responsible for paying of the taxes, but it's not going to be an immediate liability for you. Another thing is also, too, very important is if you do acquire title to a particular unit, you need to contact your insurance agent to make sure that if you need additional insurance to cover this acquisition or whether you have you already have sufficient insurance coverage. So that's it. We're going to be around, so certainly ask additional questions at that point.
One minute, please. We are going to have a board meeting immediately following this meeting. It's going to be back in the tall building. Everybody's invited to come. The room will accommodate probably a half a dozen people. But it is open to everybody, and you are invited. With that, I want to thank Paul and his firm. It's a great program.
Thanks, Paul. We'll be here as long as they need us.
Yeah.